Welcome to Security Wire Weekly, the CertSecurity.com podcast for February 4th, 2009. Welcome to the program. I'm Rob Westerveld. In this edition, a payment processor sounds off on the Heartland data security breach.
It's something that, quite frankly, is a little bit scary, and hopefully we get some details on this to tell us that Heartland had made a mistake and this wasn't something that we're all vulnerable to.
Then we'll discuss the details of the latest data breach cost study with Larry Poneman of the Poneman Institute. He says the best defense is due diligence.
It's impossible to create an environment where you cannot have a data breach. Data breaches will probably continue even for the best of companies, but it's how you respond to it, how do you detect it, how you manage the risk.
Up next, Larry Poneman of the Poneman Institute released the details of its latest data breach cost analysis. Poneman surveyed 43 companies that experienced a data breach. The report found the total average costs of a data breach grew to $202 per compromised record. That's an increase of 2.3% since 2007. But more interesting are some other survey findings. Of the firms surveyed, 84% said they experienced more than one breach, and more than 88% of all cases involved incidents of insiders mishandling data. Larry, hey, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for your interest in our paper.
The cost of a data breach grew to $202 per compromised record. That's only about 2.3% increase since 2007. Is that really significant, even though it's only 2.3%, Larry?
Well, it's a good question. $202 per record doesn't seem like a lot of money to me. But if you have 1,000 records, 10,000, a million, what was Heartland? I don't know, 100 million records? I mean, it becomes astronomically expensive, but still, the increase of 2.3% doesn't seem like a huge net change from the prior year. Here's my way of looking at it. We found that a lot of people in the privacy community generally have the view that people over time will become indifferent to a data breach notification. Like, they'll get the notice, and it'll be like the Graham Leach Bliley notice. They'll say, oh, boy, another bank lost my data. Who cares? Or another retailer lost my information. But the reality, though, is that our model suggests that that isn't declining. That's actually increasing, even albeit slight, which suggests that people haven't reached the point of indifference as yet. Because when people reach that point, that cost, you know, the cost of churn or people leaving a relationship with a company is actually, should decline. The cost should actually go down, but our findings suggest just the opposite, that the costs continue to creep up little by little each and every year. Now, there's always next year, and it could be that, the people will reach the apex, the top of the mountain this year, and then after something like Heartland and, 100 million records, they'll start to say, well, I didn't become an identity theft victim this year, so I'm not going to worry.
Right.
But I don't think it's happening that quickly.
How did companies determine the cost of lost business? The economic downturn may have played into this.
Yeah, the way we measure it, if there's one part of the model that is very, very difficult, it's all difficult. It takes a lot of effort. But the one part of the model framework that we use that is very, very difficult to quantify, we call it abnormal churn. That's the people who leave the organization above and beyond anything else that's happening in their world, because there's always churn in a company. It's they're leaving the organization because they just lost all confidence in the company. Or say you're a banking customer and you use online banking and you make a decision as a result of the breach to continue as a banking customer, but not as an online banking customer, which is actually pretty costly to the bank. So how do you measure that? And the way we do that is, for each case study, we actually go out to a subset of the individuals who've been notified of a data breach to find out their intention to churn. And that's step one. The second step is we actually determine the lifetime value of a customer. And that's, by the way, it might seem complex, but actually that information is readily available because marketers actually use that information.
Okay.
And then three, we actually try to determine then what's the economic damage if this person who churns is, you know, basically no longer your lifetime customer. And so that's how we actually compile the economic value of abnormal churn. So the higher the abnormal churn rate, typically, the higher the cost of data breach. Mm-hmm. Although there are other costs that are not relating to churn, but churn is definitely one of the variables. And I know you asked one question, but I'm going to have to give you a little bit more detail on the churn. There are really three costs in that category of lost opportunity. There's the churn of the customers notified. There's the churn of the of customers who were not actually notified, but they read about it, say, in the Wall Street Journal or New York Times or their local magazine or local newspaper. And then there's the third category, which is called the cost of customer acquisition. And this is the cost that customers spend, or companies spend, excuse me, in order to attract new customers. That cost seems to increase pretty substantially for a period of time because a data breach is such a negative effect. It's, you know, viewed as a, you know, a real slight on the trustworthiness or a hit to the brand, if you will, of the organization. So it's the combination of all of these costs that actually is the result of people losing confidence and ultimately leaving, even though they were loyal customers before.
What is churn?
Churn is turnover, usually. It's approximately that. It's the percentage to which a company, and all companies have it, it's the amount of the percentage, or it's usually as a frequency measure, of people or customers who leave in the normal course of business.
About 84% of those surveyed in the study involved cases where there was more than one data breach. Why do you think this is the case? Are businesses not learning the first time around?
In our study, we find that no matter what you do from a technology or kind of you know the human factor issue, it's impossible to create an environment where you cannot have a data breach. Data breaches will probably continue even for the best of companies. But it's how you respond to it, how do you detect it, how you manage the risk. And I think the only way to do it is a combination of good technology solutions and generally smart people. People are educated and trained appropriately. The reason why I say that is a lot of the findings of our study, not just this study, but other studies, is a lot of the security glitches that occur usually happen because of a negligent or incompetent insider rather than someone who's, you know, competent and malicious. Although in our study, we do have some cases involving a malicious or criminal activity that resulted in the data breach. But, you know, in general, how do you solve that problem? You solve it by training people and giving them tools to secure their data.
Now, 44% of firms are adding additional encryption technologies, among other security defenses. But also interesting is that more than half are going with training awareness programs. And almost half are creating additional manual procedures and controls. What are these manual procedures and controls, Larry?
Well, it could be segregation of responsibilities. It could be just supervision and monitoring activities, more internal audits. It could be self-assessments. It's kind of interesting, and I'm glad you picked up on that. I think, you know, in the technology domain, the number one technology following a breach is to expand the use of encryption. And Phil brought up a very, very good point. There's that human factor that encryption works really well when you're using it appropriately. And the gray area is, you know, how do you know it's being used appropriately? So you have to train people, and you have to have compliance and manual processes in place to ensure that, you know, people aren't doing things like, you know, disabling their encryption or sharing a password. You know, the basic blocking and tackling things and dumb things that the end users may do from time to time. But for the most part, encryption and other technologies are necessary in order to ensure a secure, protected infrastructure.
In your 2007 study, you said that organizations should focus on proactively protecting their data instead of relying on written policies and procedures and training. Yet in 2008, we're seeing companies adding these manual processes and increasing training awareness.
Well, you know, the idea has been historically, now this is, you know, I've been in the security and data protection field for a long time, but it used to be that you know, you solve 99% of your risk or the problems associated with security just by having smart people. And I think there are some very smart people who are end users who just don't understand the technology well enough. So I think training, there's a point to which training is very important, but then there's more to that. And so even though I said that in the 2007 study, I think I'm happy that training continues to be an important issue, but I also think we need to look to some technology solutions. And these, the human and the technology issues need to be married, joined together as a solution to solve some of these pretty messy problems.
Well, thanks, Larry. Well, it's been 2 weeks since Heartland Payment Systems announced a security breach of its systems. Details remain slim, but we do know that the processor was informed of certain anomalies from Visa in October of 2008. A further investigation discovered a Trojan with the ability to sniff data on its systems. It's unclear how much credit card data was stolen, but we do know that the payment processor handles over 100 million transactions a month. With me to talk about data security and payment processing systems is Merchant Warehouse CEO Henry Hegelson. Merchant Warehouse processes 3 million transactions a month, adding up to about $3.5 billion in transactions annually. Henry, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
What's your take first, on the Heartland breach thus far? There's very few details available. Are you surprised that a processor would be the target of an attack?
Would I be surprised that the processor is actually the target? No. Am I surprised that they were successful? Yes. It's something that we haven't seen before, and it's something that, quite frankly, is a little bit scary. And hopefully we get some details on this that tell us that Heartland had made a mistake, and this wasn't something that we're all vulnerable to.
Talk a little bit about your company and some of the security controls that you have in place, not only to protect from external threats, but also to protect from insiders.
We process for about 55,000 merchants nationwide. So we have quite a, I'd say we take a pretty good hard look at security on a day-to-day basis. What we did, Rob, was we hired an actual compliance officer in our office that his sole job, or one of his top responsibilities is security of the office. So he's just tasked with going out and making sure that everybody in the office understands the rules and basically running mini audits on the office itself. There was a lot of challenges with this, especially since we have our own gateway. And what we decided to do, and I think your readers are a little bit more sophisticated than the average ones, but we basically took our payment servers and took them off our network and basically put them in a secure room, and they are only attached to the processors and our merchants out there. And we do have another server that provides access to the reporting features of this. But we figured the less access points, the less vulnerabilities was the basic theory there.
In terms of PCI compliance, how long did it take you to become PCI compliant, and how much was that a priority for you? Obviously, it must have been a big priority.
Yeah, it was a very big priority. I always believed that our security standards were up to snuff, but just getting that letter, and I think a lot of processors see it, is a marketing advantage. Not only is it something that's best practices, but it also makes you look a little bit better out there as well. I personally think that PCI is a good start, and I think that the things included in there, the 12 bullet points on PCI, are good things to follow, but I don't necessarily think you stop when you get through those 12 bullet points, and processors should be going a little bit above and beyond that, as should merchants should be going above and beyond that.
Once you become compliant, obviously, it doesn't necessarily mean you are always compliant. You're compliant at that one moment. You said that your compliance officer actually continues to monitor and check security policies.
Yeah, it's really a daily process. Okay. People will try and make changes that may not be aware of all the rules or our security procedures, and they are pretty complex. Anybody who's gone into PCI knows that you're not going to be able to train 100% of your staff on every single piece of those rules. So his job is basically to act as a liaison to the staff and our merchants and make sure that everybody is following the procedures that we have in place, not just the PCI procedures, but some of the other procedures Merchant Warehouse has in place.
When you get down into the smaller business level, are there more risks that a processor takes when they begin to take on customers of that type?
You know, the risks really are in how the merchant processes, and believe it or not, this is kind of this is counterintuitive, that a lot of the larger merchants are using more sophisticated point-of-sale systems. A small merchant using a standalone terminal, it's very hard to breach those. I don't think I've heard of it happening unless somebody gets control of the physical device. So as far as a PCI standpoint goes, those are pretty low risk, the less sophisticated users we have. Now, as you step up into the larger and larger merchants, they're using point-of-sale systems that are running on operating systems that hackers are very familiar with, that have vulnerabilities, and that's one of the reasons we have to keep our patches updated. And these systems might also be talking to a back-office system before sending the transactions to us. And these larger merchants actually present a larger risk, and also they present a larger risk to us because they're processing more transactions and are potentially better target for hackers.
The larger merchants probably would be more of a target to the attacker.
Yeah, they'd be more lucrative, and because the systems are so big, they probably have more vulnerabilities than some smaller merchant stuff.
What's your take on the Heartland CEO calling for a big push on encryption?
I think a little bit of this is the blame game right now and trying to handle the PR side as best as possible. But end-to-end encryption is a great thing. I think it's going to take over. I think it should be part of PCI. You know, at some point, you still have to decrypt this to get it out to the processor, or somebody has to take a look at this, and I'm not sure that as an industry we've gotten to a point where we can take the same encrypted message and forward it all the way out to the issuing banks. That is going to take a little bit of work before we get there.
So data in motion is actually still a very big issue here.
Absolutely. And I think most of what we're seeing here is not hackers getting into a database of card numbers and track data. What they're doing is they're sniffing it on the way as it's in transit. You know, one of the big rules about PCI, I'd say that the cardinal rule of PCI is never store track data. That's the magnetic stripe information on the back of the card. And I'd say most merchants don't store that, but yet the hackers continue to get a hold of that. So I would have to theorize the only logical place they're getting that from is in transit they're being able to sniff that data as it comes through.
That does it for this edition of Security Wire Weekly. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts at our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For now, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.